What's next for IT? In today's economy, technology touches every aspect of the day-to-day operations of business. There has never been more pressure on IT to deliver for our organizations. So what can we expect over the next decade? We need to think differently about how we approach our work to continue to thrive into the future. This requires all of us to be intentional in how we look at our role going forward. Smart IT is an approach to getting the important things done by transforming the way we think, work, and lead. And now, let's disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk the smart IT way. Welcome to another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. And today, it's a pleasure to welcome Jeff to the show.
Hey, William. Great to be here.
Man, we had a fantastic conversation yesterday. And like I always tell people when we do the prep, it'll be even better if I just hit the record button. But we still got a lot of juicy, good things to talk about today. So I'm happy you got some time today to chat with my audience. So on this show, Smart IT, we like to kind of re-challenge how IT and technical professionals, you know, look at their jobs and their roles in their organizations and think a little bit more strategically and systematically about what they do, how they do it, how they approach the work they do. And that requires kind of stepping back at times, understanding the purpose of their organization, you know, how do they make money, right? They're in business to make money in most cases. And then their role in technology, if it's developing or designing or implementing or supporting or defending this digital infrastructure that, you know, their organizations run off of. And a lot of times there are a lot of moving parts, a lot of technology. You got to integrate it with a lot of processes, a lot of people. So a lot of times some professionals can get overwhelmed with, you know, how they troubleshoot a problem or how they bring attention to the stakeholders, a particular issue or an opportunity, right? How we can exploit this technology better. Or on the other hand, when they hear their business colleagues talking about a new opportunity such as AI or other emerging technologies, how can we do this safely, right? And with some guardrails to make sure we don't open the company up for too much exposure. Mm-hmm. So I love talking to my colleagues in the risk management field. So Jeff, I met you obviously through Syracuse, so a great organization. And you're doing great work out there and actually working on the book. So let's start there a little bit to give our audience a little peek into Jeff and what you've been working on the last couple of years on something called Earnbach.
Yeah. Thanks, William. I've been working on a book called The Guide to the Information Risk Management Body of Knowledge, or Earnbach, as I call it. Currently, it's 145,000 words long. In Microsoft Word, it clocks in at 642 pages. And I estimate I'm about 95% done. The last 5% seems to be the hardest, which I guess makes sense. I've saved the hardest for last. I kept kicking the can down the road. But it aspires to be the go-to reference guide, if you will, for information risk management professionals. So it covers both high level process steps, like what you might find in, say, ISO 31000 or ISO 27005. But it also has a chapter that I call the techniques chapter that has a detailed description of 36 different techniques that you could use to implement the steps of information risk management. So if anyone out there has ever read anything on risk management and wondered, you know, well, that's nice, but how do you actually do that? That's what that chapter is designed to address. That's where the real meat of the book is.
I like that. And then it's kind of interesting, the kind of the scope of risk management. You know, you just say risk management by itself, it means certain things. And then we put the E in front of it for enterprise risk management. And if people will think about ISO 31000, they'll think about COSO. And then you have this other area of cyber risk management. A lot of people doing a lot of analytical work and quantitative work there. And then in the other areas, you have this GRC space. And then you're interacting with technology folks who are actually implementing this tech and actually defending. So a lot of different elements around there. I know people kind of sometimes conflate governance with compliance and compliance with risk management. Sometimes conflating the actual hands-on work of technology with the actual analytical work in the background that helps support decision makers. So I love what you're doing with Urbach, and it really kind of really helps improve this decision-making process in organizations. Like, I love that. So let's talk a little about this, adding rigor to helping stakeholders who have to make decisions every day, right? Should we make this investment? Where should we move our capital? If there's a new emerging threat, how do we address it? How much attention should we put to it? So let's talk about how Urbach and risk analysis and just more rigor in the analysis process really helps decision makers.
When we make decisions in our daily lives outside of work, we don't make decisions the way that most computer security professionals recommend we make decisions about computer security risk. Say you're a parent, you've got young kids, and you need to take them to school. Here's what you would not do. You would not wake up and say, okay, I'm going to do a risk analysis on taking my kids to school. I'm going to identify a bunch of bad things that could happen, how likely they are to happen, how bad it would be if they were to happen. And then I'm going to somehow compare those answers or output to my risk tolerance. And if I think that it's outside my risk tolerance, we're going to stay home. And people listening right now may be thinking, what do you mean? That's exactly what we're trained to do. My response is, yeah, but that's incomplete. In the real world, we make decisions by looking at the full set of consequences, not just the bad things, but we also look at the good things that could happen. There's no universally accepted definition of risk management, but for today, we're going to pretend that it means only, it's only focused on bad things. And the counterpart to risk management, I'm going to call opportunity management, which is only focused on the upside or the good things. And so they're two sides of the same coin, and together they make up what we call decision management. So in the real world, outside of computer security, we don't do risk management in isolation. We do decision management. So we might say, if I take my kids to school, if I drive them, there's a possibility that we could get in a car accident. And that would be bad. That would be the downside. But we would also say, I mean, this all happens subconsciously. No one, I think, actually thinks through this on a daily basis. But if they thought about it consciously, they would also say, but there's an opportunity here. There's an upside. If I take them to school, there's a very high probability that they're going to get to school just fine. And they're going to be able to learn. They're going to be able to see their friends and engage. You know, they'll have social interaction, maybe some extracurriculars, whatever. And the upside is going to outweigh the downside. And so they're going to make that decision. Now, when you say it like that, it all sounds really, really obvious. And that's because it is. The problem is that the way that computer security or information security or cybersecurity professionals are trained, we are trained to only focus on the downside. And even though we don't make decisions in our personal lives that way, this is like professionally how we're trained to operate. And so it makes it really, really hard to align with, I hate using this expression, align with the business. I hate that expression because it makes it sound like cybersecurity is not part of the business. It's a very othering way of talking. But it makes it really hard to align with the decision maker's objectives. So, and it makes it really easy to sound like the person of no or the team of no, and you're just an obstacle, because that's not the way the rest of the company thinks. It's not that they don't care about risk. I actually think that the vast majority of people do care about risk. They're just not myopically focused on it the way that risk management professionals are. when I've used this example in the past, the response I've gotten is, okay, I see your point. You're right. But, you know, we are trained to analyze the bad stuff. We don't have the training or even the visibility to identify the upside, what I call the, you know, the opportunity analysis. And I would say yes and no. For the most part, the same set of techniques that we would use to identify risks can be used to identify opportunities. The same set of techniques that you would use to analyze loss event frequency, to talk like a fair person, you could just as easily use to analyze and estimate opportunity event frequency. All of it's for the most part the same analytical techniques. The key difference is access to information. Information security people are typically not, you know, super deep in market analysis. And, you know, if you work at a tech company like a SaaS company, you're not necessarily spending a lot of time talking to sales engineering to understand in depth, you know, who's the customer and what's the anticipated ARR, annual recurring revenue, that, you know, this deal might be worth. That's not typically what we do. And I'm not saying that that needs to become what we do. What I am saying is that when you're talking to a decision maker, whether it's a CTO, CFO, the board, whoever, you need to be aware that that absolutely is how they're thinking about it. And you are, at best, even if you are God's gift to risk management, you are a perfect risk estimator, you are only providing half of the equation. And so you should not be surprised or frustrated if the decision maker, whoever that is, receives your information and says, thank you very much, I've taken it under consideration, and I'm going to move forward. Risk acceptance is a perfectly valid option in risk management. And again, this is obvious, right? Even in our myopic risk management only focus as cybersecurity professionals, we all know that. But I haven't actually heard anybody say this, but it's as if we recognize, okay, yeah, it's theoretically possible that you could accept risk, but that's bad or icky or evil or somehow wrong. Nonsense. I mean, this is business. People take risks every day. And the question is whether or not the risks they are taking are truly aligned with their risk tolerance. And so if you want to do this right, not only do we need to be really good at risk identification and risk estimation, which are the bulk of the topics of the book, but, and this is something Doug Hubbard talks about, and I've learned a lot from him, but we need to get a whole lot better at understanding the risk tolerance of the decision maker. And part of that is, we could talk about how to do that, but yeah. part of what goes into risk tolerance is understanding that it doesn't necessarily mean a single value or a range of values, right? It could be, let me give an example. Pretend you're the CISO of a hospital.
Yeah.
So the kind of loss events you're concerned about would include all of the traditional outcomes that any cybersecurity professional cares about. But you would also care about loss of life or human suffering, right? Because it's a hospital. Those are things that they deal with probably on a daily basis. And so you could have a risk tolerance for loss of human life that is separate from your risk tolerance for brand damage, which is separate from your risk tolerance for loss of revenue. So the point here is that even when we think about risk tolerance, and again, I haven't read anybody or heard anybody use these exact words, but the assumption is if we think about risk tolerance, we think there's a single risk tolerance. And that doesn't make any sense. The way to think about risk tolerance is, first of all, risk tolerance, you would say, well, it's the company's risk tolerance or the hospital's risk tolerance. I mean, you can say that, but that's a fiction. It's a useful fiction, but it's a fiction. Not trying to get political in reference to, like, I think it was Citizens United, where they said, the Supreme Court said, you know, corporations are people. Yeah. But for purposes of this conversation, corporations are not people. Corporations make decisions based on the people who run them. And maybe there's a benevolent dictatorship and the CIO or the CEO is making all the decisions. But in my experience, it doesn't usually work that way. There are multiple decision makers. Each decision maker has their own risk tolerance. So we've now got two dimensions of risk tolerance. We've got the first dimension is the type of loss event, you know, for example, loss of human life versus brand damage versus loss of revenue. Yeah. And then the second dimension would be the individual decision maker. So maybe you've got an information security steering committee, or on the board of directors, you've got the audit committee. Those committees would have multiple people on them. And so you would need to understand the risk tolerance of each of the members of the committee for each of the type of loss events that you're thinking about.
Those are fantastic points, Jeff. And I do want to back up on one thing and go back to the analogy of taking your kids to school.
Yeah.
Underline it, people don't sometimes realize, but the mitigation cost are baked in already. So if we were to remove current mitigations, the loss frequency of something bad happening to you or your kid would go up. So for example, right, taxation to help build the roads, maintain the roads, street lights, the safety of the building when you get there, the cost of the police, fire. There are a lot of things that are happening that happen over decades, which makes the community that you live in safe enough to even go out into the road. The safety of the car, the seat belts. So a lot of things are baked in that we don't consciously think of that says, hey, this is something extra. We just assume it. So I always tell people when they think about, man, U.S. is relatively safe, right? But we spend over 25% of our budget every year on defense. Those are costs here. Now, if somebody said we wanted to go from 25% down to 5%, then all of a sudden your safety could be different. Your occurrence of bad things happening could go up. And I think for some reason on our side, on the cyber side, it's like some of the basic functionality isn't there. Like we wouldn't spin up a new workload, but like an antivirus and a firewall. So in some cases, companies don't have it because it's new function. So when you get that initial investment, the business has to think about why is this there? It's like, well, we need to get the roads down. We need to get the fire department there. We need to fund this. And at a certain level, we're not keep asking for more tooling or technology. We're operationalizing it, and it's just a standard. When we stand up a new plant overseas, there are going to be physical security and gates and dogs, antivirus, bat. It's built in. It's not special. So I think sometimes we forget how much we're investing on physical security side of the house. When we get tax it, we got bonds. There's a lot going in to make things safe enough to go outside with your family, feel safe. Not worry about mm-hmm. somebody coming across the border and taking your stuff. But I love the whole concept of decision management, and that's really important, right? To orient the mind of the cyber person. We're going to expand. We're going to build AI. How do you do it and mitigate the most obvious risk? How much risk is it to do AI? And I think that's the input of the cyber and technology people where they get that input, as opposed to saying, no, don't do it. No. How do you help your business counterpart do it safely, right? Without exposing data or intellectual property. I'm just loving the discussion, man, because it just really hits home on what's the other side of opportunity. Okay, risk. You're in the discussion with your counterparts to assist, not to say no or stop it. And I think that would alleviate a lot of frustration when they say, well, I can't get more stuff approved.
Yeah, and with all due respect to my colleagues, including especially those who have the title of CISO, but I used to go to all of these CISO only events on a regular basis. You get, they're sponsored by a vendor at a really expensive restaurant, and then there'll be someone brought in as the draw, typically like a very senior CISO who's the speaker. So the vendor, you know, is basically paying money for a contact list, and they'll follow up with you after the dinner. But the dinner itself is a networking opportunity, and then you get to hear the guest speaker speak. And after a while, it's like, okay, my waistline's getting bigger, but I'm not getting smarter. Yeah. And so I actually stopped going to these back in like 2018 until one I went to about a month ago. It was the first one I went to, and it was fantastic. But the reason I'm telling the story is that when I would go, I got frustrated. I kept hearing the same set of complaints from CISOs. And it would be things like what you just said, where people would say, the business just doesn't get it.
Yeah.
They don't understand. There's all this risk bad. We need to do stuff, and I can't get the funding. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't say this out loud, but I'm thinking to myself, how are you keeping your job? You are a CISO. You're like supposed to be able to handle that conversation.
Yes.
So I apologize in advance to anyone watching this or listening who I just criticized, but I think that that is an essential skill, not just for a CISO, but even for a GRC director or manager or risk manager, is to be able to articulate the decision analysis, which includes the risk analysis, in a way that lines up. So another thing we will hear is you need to align with the business. And I think I already mentioned, I don't like that way of talking because that's othering. But if you do risk management the way that I promote and other people promote, like Doug Hubbard and the Society for Information Risk Analysts, it would be impossible to use those methods and not be aligned with the business, to not speak the language of business. Like, again, use that example of a hospital CISO. If you truly understand the decision maker's perspective and you understand that there are distinct loss event types that can't be reduced to one another, like you would, some people would say there is a dollar value of human life. Maybe there is for insurance purposes, but I think most people would say those are two different things. Sort of like you can't reduce the outside air temperature to dollars. You'd say that's a category error. That doesn't make sense. You need to understand how the decision maker thinks about loss events. And in the hospital, probably the decision maker, the CEO or the board of the hospital, would say that patient outcomes is a totally different category from revenue, which is totally different from something else, legal compliance, we'll say. And so if you understand these different categories, truly understand them and align to them, then that's going to affect everything you do as a risk management professional. It's going to affect the way you think. It's going to affect the way that you conduct your analysis. It's going to affect the way that you communicate the results, because if they truly are focused on patient outcomes, which would include things like death, suffering, unnecessary amputations, I don't know, whatever it is, then but they also care about revenue, then everything that you say is going to be pivot or index off of those types of outcomes. Like, how could you not speak their language if you do that? So a lot of what the book talks about is how to do quantitative methods. And again, I guess you could say a disciple or a fan of Doug Hubbard on that topic. But what I'm talking about right now has nothing to do with math. So you might be the most anti-math person out there. You see numbers and you get nervous. What I'm saying right now has nothing to do with math or numbers. I mean, this is just really basic conceptual categories. I'll pause there so that you look like you wanted to get a word in.
Yeah, that's a key point there, right? A lot of cyber professionals are going off frameworks or theoreticals. Oh my God, the bad guys can do all this bad stuff to us. There's nation states after us, cyber criminals after us. Everybody's after us. This could happen. Like, everything could happen. However, if you're going to ask for something, right? If you're going to introduce more friction with three more technical controls, like maybe we don't need a doctor doing MFA three times when they need to get access to the medical record for a patient in there, right? So we have to understand how the technology is interfacing with the humans and don't create friction, which would actually hurt the business. So maybe we call them exceptions, like, oh my God, we can't implement this, where there's a reason why, because you're there to serve patients, not to do MFA necessarily, interrupting what the nurses and doctors are doing. So I like that focus in on what the business is doing, because you should start your language there as opposed to, hey, I need this new detection tool because it looks good at a conference, the demo well, and you're going to ask for the money, like, how's it helping with, like you said, patient outcomes, saving money, brand recognition. And I think that's a good point too, that you also made about the security folks hanging out with themselves. It could become an echo chamber. So the other one I got is a pet peeve, not only about the business people don't understand them. My pet peeve is they always downgrade the user, right? The end user, like they're stupid for clicking on something. Well, the job of email is to collaborate and communicate to run the business. So you're talking about hovering over links for people who got massive amount of emails, which is running business processes. So you know that we need to click links. You know how adversaries work. You know that you understand their tactics. You should. So you should build your system to handle the fact that sometimes a bad link might be clicked on and stop dumping on end users, right? Who are doing a job for their business. So I think some cybersecurity professionals get locked into this adversary role with end users, and it's their fault, as opposed to how can I help them do their work and mitigate it. So maybe the bad guys get in. I got other non-technical ways of mitigating that risk on the back end, which is fine. And like you said before, businesses are accustomed to handling risk in all different flavors, and they've been doing it ever since their inception as a company.
Yep. Yeah, it's to use another parenting analogy, anyone who's a parent will immediately understand this, but when your kids are young, I mean, really young, they need a nap. And if they don't get their nap, there's no risk. There's certainty. There's absolutely no doubt what's going to happen. They're going to get really cranky. It's going to be a miserable experience for everyone. So let's say that for whatever reason, they don't get their nap. Maybe you were running errands and you're out and about and doing something really stimulating and exciting for the kid, and they're not able to nap in the stroller while you're at the ball, or you couldn't get home fast enough for their nap time, whatever. There may be a really good reason, but the bottom line is they weren't able to get their nap on time or at all. So then what happens? Well, they have a complete meltdown, a tantrum. Now, as a parent, if you are at this exact moment, you know, you're watching this podcast, you have small children, you know, I empathize with you. I'm at a different stage in my life. My kids are adults now, but in the moment, you can get really frustrated, especially if this has happened, you know, a lot in recent memory. But if you're able to take a step back, you would say, you know, the situation sucks, but it's fundamentally irrational and unfair to get angry with my kid for having a totally predictable reaction when they don't get their nap. The analogy here is that, to use your example of, you know, the end user, say they're clicking on links they shouldn't in emails that are either, you know, actual adversarial emails as part of, you know, their phishing, or it's a simulated phishing campaign, maybe done by you or someone that works for you. I would say, with apologies to all end users out there, there's a little bit of an analogy here between the end user and the young kid who didn't get their nap. It's simply not realistic to assume that 100% of end users are going to 100% of the time do the right thing when it comes to clicking or not clicking on suspicious links in the emails that they get. So you can say this, you know, this sucks. It's really frustrating. It creates a headache for me as a cybersecurity professional because now I have to mitigate this. Okay, but that's really no different than the parent of a young kid saying, this sucks. I have to plan my day around my kid's nap time. Well, yeah, you do. Welcome to being a parent. And then, you know, same thing with phishing, to beat that dead horse. Yeah, it is frustrating that that's an attack vector, and welcome to cybersecurity. I mean, it's a package deal. That's part of what you've signed up for.
Yes, inclusive, like a bank. Bank fraud happens every single day, but guess what? Banks are still making money. They understand what the range of the loss is probably going to be next year. They put a certain amount of investment to help reduce it, but they're not going to overspend or make the experience with the customer too arduous that we would lose customers. So that balancing act is always there. But the fact that they're in business means they know what they're doing. The business folks know what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. You just remind me of something else, which is that when you said the word spend too much money. So here's another part of risk orthodoxy that I think needs to die a quick death. According to risk orthodoxy, you do your risk analysis, whether it's with quantitative methods a simple high, medium, low, red, yellow, green, whatever. And you've got a risk, and somehow you've determined this is not an acceptable risk. It's outside of our risk tolerance. And then your job is to be able to go to your organization and say, and here's what I recommend you do about it. Because by definition, it's outside of risk tolerance. So that implies you're not supposed to accept the risk, right? So what's the problem? The problem is that in the real world, we not only think about whether or not a risk is within our tolerance, we also think about what's the cost to implement the safeguard, and do I have the budget for it? Yeah. And even if I do have the budget for it, what is it competing with? Because I don't have budget for everything. And so it's possible that initially you would say a risk is outside of a risk tolerance, and the only mitigation you have costs $1 bazillion. And it just happens that you don't have the $1 bazillion to spend. So now what? Does information security get to bankrupt the company by taking up the entire budget for this one safeguard? Probably not. If you could make it happen, that would be interesting, but I'm going to guess that's not what's going to happen. And so in that scenario, is the decision maker irrational, evil, or stupid for saying, yeah, I'm not going to do that, Jeff. I'm going to recalibrate my risk tolerance. And all of a sudden that's within risk tolerance because you haven't given me an option I can afford. Or here's another example. Say it doesn't cost $1 bazillion. Say it costs something far more reasonable, whatever that is. Maybe it's a $50,000 software tool. You have that amount of money in your budget, but you also have 10 other risks that you need to treat. And so you need to prioritize, and you're not going to be able to treat them all. And so where I'm headed with this is you not only need to look at, is the risk within your tolerance or the decision maker's tolerance, you also need to compare the amount of risk reduction, the ratio of risk reduction to the cost of the proposed safeguard. And there's an actual metric for this. It's called RRPUC, risk reduction per unit cost. What should happen, and almost nobody does this, is you can't do this unless you're doing quantitative risk management, is you not only quantitatively estimate your risk, you quantitatively estimate your amount of risk reduction, which enables you to do a simple division problem to come up with the ratio risk reduction per unit cost. So if I know that for some risk, I can reduce my annualized loss expectancy by $1 million a year, and the cost of the proposed safeguard is $10,000, well, I've got a really favorable ratio. It's much greater than one. And imagine if you did that for all of the risks that you identified. You could then sort your risk register based on open risks in decreasing value of risk reduction per unit cost. And so you would start with the things where you get the most bang for your buck. And so this has some counterintuitive results, counterintuitive if you're not used to thinking this way. What is very possible is that risks that previously would have been viewed as, let's say, medium risks, and so might not have gotten any budget at all, all of a sudden they're the ones that are first in line for funding, and some of your high risks are either, you know, at the bottom of the list or they're above the line but farther down the list. And this is totally contrary to risk orthodoxy, because the way orthodoxy thinks is it says you only look at the overall level of risk, the level of inherent risk, and you sort on that. You start with the highest risk first, work your way down until you hit a stopping point, usually when you run out of money. But again, that's not the way that in the real world people make decisions. That's certainly not how, say, the CEO would evaluate a bunch of different ways to spend money on an advertising campaign.
Right.
They would want to know, you know, because that's an opportunity. That's a positive outcome. They would want to look at, you know, what has the best ROI. RRPUC is not ROI. It's not even ROSI, but it's adjacent to those categories. And the concept is the same. You want to analyze, you know, how much bang for your buck are you getting? This is the way that the rest of the organization thinks. And so again, if you use a method like that, it's impossible not to be aligned with the way that your decision makers think. They probably are not going to articulate it the way that I just did, but this is exactly how, like, the CFO and everyone in the CFO's organization is absolutely thinking the way that I just described.
I love that. That clarity, that's just very powerful there. And the other thing that just got me thinking about this, the assumption is once they actually got the investment approved for these additional safeguards, that was actually implemented in a timely manner, right? Mm-hmm. We all know about these shelfware, right? You wanted the money, you got the money, you got the tech, and you come back 6 months, 9 months, 12 months later, and you look at, is it completely implemented? Is it implemented correctly? Is everything turned on? Have you optimized the operations of the safeguard? And in some cases, the answer is no. But depending on how the technical people communicate back on that quarterly board meeting, it says $1 million invested, safeguard's up and running. You actually go and test it. Maybe you do a pen test, or maybe you do a health check, and you find out this tooling, this safeguard is not implemented the way it should be. And because of that, we have false assumption it's actually mitigating risk. And it may not, because the way it's been implemented, either it's internal limitations on the implementation, or maybe the vendor who tool you're using has some issues. Maybe you had to turn the feature off because it was a compatibility problem. That's a long list of companies that are running technology halfway, partial, or not the way you were expecting. And mm-hmm. I think CISOs and technology people got to own up to that, because if you ask for the money and can't get it implemented correctly in a timely manner, that's a problem right there. That's wasted money right there.
Agreed.
Man, this is pretty powerful. So I do want to hit on this one point you mentioned earlier, right? Because I know a lot of people are intimidated. We hang out at the CERICON events, the monthlies, the conferences. We do Doug Hubbard's work, Sam Savage's work. A lot of people out there with FAIR. But some people are intimidated by the whole concept of cyber risk quantification or probabilistic management, or they think, oh my God, these numbers, I can't, Jeff, it's too complicated for me. I can't get started. So that's somebody else. So what are you saying to these people who are saying, we just need to stick to high, medium, and low?
I would say several things. First of all, start with empathy. If that's you, the listener, I would say, I get it. Math is not for everyone. I would offer the following points to consider. Number one, the kind of things that we're talking about in CIRA, Doug Hubbard's books, the book that I'm writing, the Information Risk Management Body of Knowledge, and others, I would say it's roughly at a 10th grade math level. So it's not counting like arithmetic that a first grader would learn. But the important point here is that it's not a PhD in statistics level of math. I do not have a PhD. I certainly don't have one in statistics. I don't even have a bachelor's degree in math. I completed all the coursework for a minor in math, and I never actually declared it. So my diploma doesn't say I have a minor in math, but I could go get that fixed. I have a minor in math. My major was computer science, but the stuff that I learned as an undergraduate math minor, I'm not really using any of that stuff. I guess there's a little bit if I were to work with what's called a probability distribution, but I also learned that in high school math. But for the most part, we're talking about stuff that's like 10th grade math, algebra one. So if you can do algebra one, you can do most of what we talk about when we talk about quantitative risk management. If that's simply too much for your ability or your comfort level, then quantitative risk management is not for you. What's weird is, let me make another analogy. Suppose that you were in a software engineering team, and through some weird science fiction scenario, it's been possible for the software engineering team to operate for decades without actually writing code. You have people with the title software engineer, but many of them, perhaps most of them historically, are not programmers. They don't even know programming languages. And so you'd say, well, then what are they doing? They write English. They write paragraphs that describe what computer scientists would call pseudocode. So it's not like they're just sitting around playing board games all day. They're doing stuff, but what they're doing is not programming. And if you're you know, sort of tilting your head and frowning, and it's like, what in the world is this guy talking about? That's exactly the reaction you should be having. It would be absolutely bizarre to encounter someone who says, Jeff, what do you mean? I'm a software engineer. I don't program. That's programming. I do software engineering. And our reaction would be, what do you mean? What are you talking about? That makes no sense. But for some reason, it is completely acceptable to say, I'm a risk manager. I'm a risk analyst. I don't actually deal with probabilities. I don't deal with numbers. That's mathy. That's math stuff. That's someone else. And I want us to get to the point where people have the same reaction to a non-quantitative risk manager as they do to a non-programmer software engineer. Both should provoke a response of, what? What are you talking about? This is crazy talk.
Yeah, I love that.
Programming is not for everyone. There are no value judgments here. If programming is not your thing, I'm not going to say that you're a bad person. I am, however, going to say probably should not have a career in software engineering, right? Same thing with risk management. Today, it is possible to have a career in GRC specifically in risk management and completely avoid anything that's mathy. You can do that. You could probably have a 30 to 40 year career getting away with that. What I'm proposing is you should not be able to get away with that. So if you are able to lean in and use roughly 10th grade math, you should be able to learn the skills that you need to learn to do quantitative risk management. And if you're unable or unwilling to do that, again, you might be able to get away with it. I don't think that you should. And so I know that's going to be provocative, and you know, some people are going to bristle at that. But we go back to, why do we do risk management? It's not because there's a law like HIPAA, which actually does say you're supposed to do a security risk assessment. It's not because a law says it. It's not because the PCI data security standard has a requirement that says you're supposed to do it. It's not because ISO 27001 says you're supposed to do it. Because for all of those things, we can ask, but why did they write those requirements into that framework? The answer is The only answer is to make better decisions. That's the reason you do risk management. It might fill a compliance checkbox, but that's a secondary benefit. The primary benefit is to make better decisions. And so however you're doing risk management, whether it's a Ouija board, high, medium, low, or quantitative methods, you can ask the question, does your method actually work? And now I'm channeling Doug Hubbard full on. And the evidence shows that quantitative methods massively and consistently outperform non-quantitative methods. So, when I drive my car down the highway, I'm driving my car partially because I know that I can rely upon the speedometer and the brakes. If I had no idea if the brakes worked, I would not drive my car down the freeway. I would not drive my car down the freeway if I knew that the speedometer is going to say I'm going 70 when I'm actually going 120. I would not choose to put myself in that situation. Why then would organizations choose to put themselves in a situation where they're making decisions about things that are really important using methods that don't work? And the high, medium, low, red, yellow, green heat map doesn't work. And we know this, we can prove it. A guy with a PhD in risk management from MIT, a scholar named Tony Cox, has actually written a rigorous mathematical academic proof showing that it doesn't work, and he can quantify exactly how much it doesn't work. And it turns out that if organizations would get better outcomes if instead of using a red, yellow, green heat map, they simply flipped a coin. Because when you flip a coin to make a decision, at least then you have a 50% chance of getting it right. Whereas if you're using, if I remember correctly, if you're using a 3x3 or 5x5 risk matrix, the chance of making the correct decision is only something like 22%. So why would you pay someone $150,000 a year or more, fully loaded salary plus benefits, to get the right outcome 22% of the time when you could just flip a quarter, which costs nothing other than the quarter, and get the correct answer 50% of the time? It makes no sense. So yeah, I am absolutely pro quantitative methods, and I am anti high, medium, low, red, yellow, green methods. And I recognize that some people are not able or willing to embrace that. And I would say you either need to get with the program or be prepared for, a career change, not leaving computer security, but maybe in GRC, you do the G and the C and leave the R to others. Because I think there is a tide, there's a change coming. Yeah. And I think the change is going to be clearly on the side of cyber risk quantification. How long is it going to take? I don't know. I mean, maybe it'll be 30 years before cyber risk quantification is universally adopted. But that day will come, and people will look back at today as the dark ages of cybersecurity risk management. It'll be like, that's like alchemy. Yeah. What were they thinking? So no disrespect intended to anyone. Again, I don't judge someone who's not willing to become a programmer or doesn't want to become a programmer. I don't judge someone who's not comfortable or able to be a quantitative risk manager. I do think, however, that organizations should not allow risk management to be done in a way that is not quantitative, because we already know that doesn't work. You may think it works. You may have a placebo effect, but that's all that it is. It's a placebo. It's not actually working. And you have no basis to claim that it is working. And what should happen, and I'll get off my soapbox so that you can respond, William, is the decision maker, board of directors, audit committee, information security steering committee, whoever, they should be asking the CISO or the risk manager, the GRC director, whoever, okay, William, you presented this to me, you're using a certain methodology, but what's the evidence this actually works? When you say that a risk is red or high versus another risk is low or green, how in the world am I supposed to have any confidence at all that you're correct? I wouldn't listen to a weather forecaster who continually tells me that there's a 90% probability of a blizzard in Honolulu, and yet it never happens in a millennium. So how do I know you're not the equivalent of that, you know, crazy Honolulu weather forecaster who keeps predicting blizzards at the equator that never happen? And obviously you're not that ridiculous, but the point is, how do I know that any of this stuff actually works? And if you're not using quantitative methods, I respectfully suggest you don't have a good answer to that question. Not because there's something wrong with you, but because there's something wrong with the methods. Those methods simply don't work.
And I think the good news for everybody who's listening, there are ways to get started, right? To take the up-level your professional skill sets. And I love the work you're doing with Earnbach. It's a way to get started, right? There are institutions, there are communities, there's groups, there's readings out there where you can start this journey to up-level what you can do and really provide more value to your organization. So this has been very powerful, Jeff. Any updates on Earnbach, where it sits right now for the audience?
Yeah, I currently have some extra time on my hands, so I am hoping that this will be the year that I finally finish the thing. But as risk managers using quantitative methods, you should be skeptical of my claim, because I've said this a few times in the past. I've been working on this book for 12 years. So the last 5% of the book has been the hardest. Maybe using generative AI, ChatGPT or Copilot or Gemini, will help me get over my writer's block and I can finally finish those last few sections. We'll see. But if you join CIRA, go to societyinforisk.org, as a member, you should be able to get access to the PDF file that has the latest draft of the book. And so you don't have to wait for the book to be finished. You can view the latest draft right now.
That's fantastic. And we'll post some links to that and some other organizations where folks can get started. And hey, there's an opportunity out there to take your professional career to the next level. And I'm really excited what's available. Jeff, man, I love this conversation, man. Fantastic. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me, William. Happy to talk about this anytime.
All right. So at this time, we're going to wrap this episode of the Smart IT Podcast. Until next time, take care. Thanks for joining another episode of the Smart IT Podcast, where we explore what's next for IT and disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk together. If you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, and leave your comments. And for more Smart IT wisdom, check out my website at williamreed.info.